Welcome to the Wave Guides Podcast, home of the South Cars TNT Open Forum.
Good evening, everyone. This is South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the South Cars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCAR server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System provided by KB8, DGL, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such, and all stations will be worked in the order in which they checked in. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com, and for our digital operation, at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net control for this session is N1SUZ. My name is Suzanne, and I am located in Danbury, Connecticut, with a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit. Prior to starting the session, I would like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. If there is, please come aboard now. Okay, do we have anyone celebrating their birthday this week? If so, please come aboard now and let us help you celebrate. Okay, this is the Thursday Night Thematic Open Forum, or TNT for short. This net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. Now, let me advise all stations connected tonight that this net may be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast, and all stations participating will be part of that recording. Let me drop here for a second. Our topic for tonight's TNT is gun safety. No matter what your views are on the ownership of guns, gun safety or knowing how to handle a gun safely can only help prevent accidents. And it is noted over and over again in various statistics that education decreases accidents. Whether you're a hunter, enjoy target shooting, or own a gun for protection, voluntary training has decreased firearms accidents. NRA firearm safety programs are conducted by more than 62,000 NRA certified instructors nationwide. Youngsters learn firearm safety in NRA programs offered through civic groups such as the Boy Scouts, the JCs, and in their schools. The NRA has a program, in fact, called the Eddie Eagle Safe Gun program that teaches children pre-K through third grade that if they see a gun without supervision, they should stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult. Since 1988, Eddie has been used by 26,000 schools, civic groups, and law enforcement agencies to reach more than 22 million children. Tonight we welcome not one, but two NRA certified instructors, the husband and wife team of Eric and Nancy Shanahan. They've been instructors for 16 years plus and have come here tonight to share their knowledge about gun safety. Thank you, Eric and Nancy, for taking time out of your very busy lives to come aboard TNT tonight.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And thank you.
Very good. Let me drop it here and we'll start our program.
Remember,
okay. Well, let's start our program tonight with a little background on you two. Nancy, first, oftentimes women get involved in the target shooting or in the enjoyment of the sports of guns because of a husband, boyfriend, or other male figure in their lives. Can you tell me, Nancy, how you became involved and what motivated you to become an instructor?
Well, I basically got involved because Eric and I were getting married, and I decided that if I was going to be living with guns, that I should have knowledge to know if the guns were loaded, how to properly handle, et cetera, which I had no exposure or experience with guns. So the first couple of times I tried it, was very nervous, very scared, and then once I realized that it's not the gun that causes problems, but it's the people behind the guns, I had more confidence in myself to be able to explore the possibility of teaching. We are also a member of a shooting club, which involves handguns, shotguns, and has archery. And I decided with some of the programs that they ran, they taught children. They had a children's day. They also had ladies' day. And I was able to assist with training new people on how to use guns safely. So that's basically my involvement.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you very much. And let me also ask you, do you think that women should be afraid? I mean, it's not really a big sport for women, or do you think that a lot more women would get more involved if they, you know, followed the path that you did?
I'm seeing now, basically at our club, more women are starting to get involved. When I first started, I was the only woman on the actual pistol range, and since time has gone on, there's probably maybe a handful of women now that actually shoot on the leagues for the pistol range. So it's getting where women are becoming more a part of this type of club or getting involved in the sport.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Nancy. And so let me ask you, Eric, and we might come back to that too, Nancy, a little bit more about us women in the sport. But let me ask you, Eric, how did you get involved?
I've been shooting since I was about 6 years old, and I've competed in different, all the different venues of shooting, such as shotgunning and skeet and trap, sporting clays, as well as NRA certified pistol shooting and rifle shooting. And so for me, it was just a natural culmination of all my years of shooting to go forward and become an instructor and to be able to teach others. I really get my enjoyment out of teaching others as much as shooting myself. And for me, you know, the bringing other people into the sport and the enjoyment of it makes it worthwhile for me.
So was that your dad that you started you in the sport?
Sort of. Really more my uncle than my dad. My dad passed away fairly young, and my uncle kind of took over as my surrogate father at that point in time, and he lived in upstate New York out in the boonies on 80 acres, and so he used to do a fair amount of shooting, and so every time we went up there, I did quite a bit of shooting, and, you know, I was lucky to have parents who were open to all sorts of different things, and so I started shooting at 6 with a BB gun. You know, they were open to that at the time. I know a lot of parents wouldn't be.
All right, well, thanks, Eric. All right, as instructors, what do you need to learn to be able to teach others to do this?
Well, we're at the instructor level, what's considered the instructor level, and there's a step above that in the NRA, and they teach the class for the instructors to learn how to actually teach well and get across all the information you need to impart to your students. And that, off the top of my head, that's a 2-day class, I believe.
Okay, and so now are you guys going to think about going to that next level to teach the instructors?
Oh, maybe at some point in time, not at this moment.
All right, good enough. All right, let's break here for a second, and this is N1SUZ, and this is the TNT Open Forum. Let me drop it for a minute. Okay, and after you learn how to teach, what do you teach? Are you mostly in the classroom, or are you out in the range teaching? And I know you both belong to a gun club, and Nancy just talked about that. Do you teach just at your gun club, or do you also do anything else?
Well, most of our classes we actually teach right out of our home. We're fortunate and do have the ability to shoot right in our own yard, as well as at our club, which is actually just about across the street from our house. So we can shoot in either spot. So we teach most of the classes right out of our home. It in the state of Connecticut, it's technically a 6 to 8 hour class. You're required to shoot at the end of the class. However, the shooting part of it is really not the largest part of it. Most of the class is denoted to, first off, gun safety. That's the most important thing, obviously, right, is gun safety. Proper handling of the guns, how to handle different revolvers, how to handle different semi-automatics, how to clean the guns, proper stance, proper hand-eye coordination, and proper aiming and trigger control, all the things that it takes to shoot a gun well. And then, of course, at the end of the class, when we do go out and finally shoot, hopefully all those things come together and I can have you putting bullets right into the black on the target. You know.
Now, shooting at the target at the end of the class, if you can't do that, that's not really proving that you're not safe with the gun. You're just a bad shot, right? Do you have to shoot the target to get your license?
Well, you actually don't have to hit the paper to get your certification.
Oh, good.
However, at the end of my class, I make certain that everybody can hit the paper.
I can see that in you, Eric. Okay. Now, would you say that most gun accidents are caused by ignorance or carelessness?
Well, actually, they're caused by both. And it's, you know, I couldn't give you a percentage as to which one causes more accidents. But obviously ignorance is a big factor in it, and ignorance means not having the knowledge of how to handle the gun properly, how to check it, make sure that it's empty. You know, carelessness on the other side of that is, well, you didn't know that the gun wasn't empty, and you pointed it at somebody. And you pull the trigger. I mean, you know, it all kind of works together. If you're careless with it, you drop it, you're handling it unsafely, and you throw it against the wall or something, well, then it might go off depending on what type of gun it is. Yeah. Some can, some don't. So it takes into account a lot of different things, and there's no way to say that ignorance or carelessness is a larger
primary
contributing factor.
Right.
Both of them absolutely contribute to accidents.
Okay, so now that we're into guns a little bit here, let's talk about gun safety. Really get into this tonight. That's what we really want to talk about. What are the fundamental gun safety rules everyone should follow, regardless of what type of gun they own?
Okay, well, the three basic safety rules are always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. When you talk about that, you have to not only know your target, but know what's beyond your target. And this doesn't always apply just to when you're shooting. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction means even if you think the gun is empty and you've got it on a table at the house, keep it pointed in a safe direction. You know, don't put it down on the table facing your wife's room. You know, your bedroom where your wife's sitting. You know, keep it pointed, you know, unless it's... But you understand. You know, you want to keep it always pointed in a safe direction. Never have it pointed towards anything that you don't expect to hurt.
All right, that makes
okay?
sense.
You know, down is always the safest possible direction, unless you're on the second or third floor, and there's somebody underneath you. So this is a consideration you need to think about as well in your home. Outdoors, down is always safe.
Okay.
Second rule is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire the gun. Now, that's pretty straightforward. When I talk about it in my class, I always say the only real safeties in handling guns, there are two of them. And if you could all see this, you would see what I'm doing. I'm holding my finger up in the air. That's your number one safety. And I'm pointing it at my head. That's your number two safety. Your mind and your finger are the two most important safeties when you're handling guns. So with your mind, you're making sure that you're pointing the gun in a safe direction. You're keeping your finger off the trigger so that you're certain that you cannot fire the gun. You know, guns cannot fire themselves. It's always the person behind them who's pulling the trigger. And, of course, the last one is always keep your guns unloaded until you're ready to use them. In that rule, no matter whether you believe the gun is empty or not, always keep it pointed in a safe direction. We go back to rule number one, okay? When you do have your guns ready to use, quote-unquote, that can be you're at the range, you're ready to shoot at targets. If you do have a permit to carry a gun, well, putting it on your side to carry it is readying it to be used. Okay, hopefully you will never get into that situation where you would have to use it. However, if it's unloaded and it's on your side, it doesn't do you any good.
Right.
So you need to prepare for that.
All right, and that brings to mind that you're telling us not to have the gun loaded unless we're going to use it, basically. But in order to have it for protection in the house, you do need to have it loaded. So.
Right.
Right. So basically, it's kind of a catch-22. You don't want to have it loaded, but you do want to have it loaded, right?
Well, when we're talking about home safety, and, you know, there's a lot of factors that come into that. Are you just a husband and wife? Do you have children? Do you have family that may come over? Does that family have children? You know, you need to take all these things into account, and each person is going to have a different set of rules to work by when they have a loaded gun in the home that they want to use for protection. You know, me and my wife are both instructors. We have no children. We can fairly safely keep a gun loaded in the house without any issues because we don't even have any family that brings children over. So we don't have that issue to deal with. If you have that issue to deal with, then it's, you know, a whole nother set of rules that you have to consider when you're keeping that gun safely in your home. There are a number of ways to keep the gun safely in your home. There are locked boxes that you can mount on on the bottom of your bed, on your night table. There are, and they work with either finger pressure or a three-button opening, so you can open it quickly and still get to it, but it's like a steel lockbox. We have a clock radio. That's the alarm clock. Well, it's also a steel box, and it's right on the radio is a button keypad, and you push the right buttons, and you can flip it open and take your gun out. Okay, so there's many different ways to have safety in the home and not be concerned about children getting hold of it.
Right. You know, it's interesting you talk about the boxes because I didn't really realize, you know, I've known about safes, firearm safes and lock boxes, but it's interesting to know about the whole clock thing. Of course you would know all that. So we'll have to talk more about that. But let me break right now. And this is N1S, she's at Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum. Let me take a short break here and open up the floor for any questions that anyone may have for either Eric or Nancy about anything we've talked about or any gun questions you might want to ask. If you have any questions or comments, please come aboard now with your suffix only, please.
Six, Victor.
Well, Six, Victor. Gordon, come on aboard.
Hey, Susie. Thanks for running the show tonight, and a very good evening to you, Eric and Nancy. Thank you for coming by with us tonight and sharing your talents. My name is Gordon. I'm talking to you from Central Florida, a little bit inland from Daytona Beach. And I imagine you're going to get into this, so you don't have to get into my question in any detail at this point until you're ready. I'm interested in knowing how the various states handle the concealed weapon permits. As an example, being in Florida, having a permit here, and then traveling to another state, what do I need to consider? If I was to come up to Connecticut, as an example, would my Florida permit be applicable up there? Is there reciprocity? There's a nice word between the states. Or do you have to handle everybody one-on-one? Back to you, Susie, KY6V. Thank you.
Well, that's a great question, Gordon, and especially since Eric, Nancy, and I went and got a Utah gun permit this weekend, which is good in 36 states. Is it 36 states?
35 states.
Right. And so we went and did that this past Saturday. But let me hand this over to Eric, our resident expert, and he will cover that.
Hi, Gordon. Nice to meet you. And that is a very good question. Reciprocity is an interesting thing and unfortunately is not universal across the country. You having a Florida permit, you are reciprocal with, I believe, 33 or 34 states. I can't remember off the top of my head, and I don't have the map in front of me, so I can't tell you which ones, but Connecticut is not one of them. The basic rule is if you are legal in the state that you are leaving from and you're legal in the state you're going to, you can bring the gun with you. However, if you're traveling through any states that you are not legal in, you need to have the gun in a lockbox with the ammunition separate from it while you're traveling through that state. Now, let's say, for example, you were traveling through New Jersey to get to Connecticut, and you were legal in Connecticut and legal in Florida. You would be legal doing that in the manner that I stated. However, if Aunt Jane lives in New Jersey and you decide to stop at her house on your way, you've just become illegal. So if you were to get caught or stopped and they found that gun on you or in the car, you would most definitely be in jail in New Jersey.
Back to you, Gordon. Does that answer some of your question? And you can ask a little bit more if you need to.
No, I think that covered it very well. Thank you very much, Eric. Would you care to touch on for a moment with all our home security networks these days and airline patting downs, how do I get from Florida to a state that will honor my permit and transport it via the airlines? Over.
It is. That's an excellent question, and I will be honest with you and tell you that my knowledge of airline transport is probably not up to snuff as it should be. Airlines are another world. I'll tell you right now, if you were to go to New York, forget it. You bring a handgun, you're going to jail. That's the way it is, because you're stopping at the airport. That they consider that a stop. You know, if you're going other states, like, you know, if you're going to Tennessee, you could probably walk into Tennessee, hand them a cased handgun, they'd throw it in the plane, and if you were flying down to Florida or flying from Florida up to Tennessee, that'd be no issue whatsoever. It unfortunately is a state-by-state thing, and it's something that if you decide or plan to travel, it's something that you need to look at the laws in the areas you're going to, or speak with officials who would be able to answer those questions, such as the Department of Public Safety or State Police, whichever is easiest to get a hold of. That's usually the same thing, actually. But it's unfortunate that we don't have an easy federal law that covers all the states. You know, that every year they try and pass one. But generally speaking, it doesn't make it through. And for the foreseeable future, I don't believe that there will be a federal, quote-unquote, federal carry permit that will allow us to travel through the whole country easily.
All right. That's a wrap from me at the moment. Thank you very much, Eric. And thank you, Nancy. And back to you, Susie, KY6B.
All right. Well, thanks, Gordon. It's a great topic, and particularly of interest to us because of what we did this weekend. And we learned a lot about carry laws in all the different states. And we had a great instructor who really was talking about the ropes about doing that. So this is N1SUZ. My name is Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum. And let's continue on with our gun safety questions for Eric and Nancy. Let me ask you, we've learned about the fundamentals. Let's talk about the guns. Is there a difference in handling a revolver and a semi-automatic? And maybe you can tell us what the difference is between semi-automatic and revolver for anybody out there who doesn't know.
Okay, well, when we talk about safety and handling the guns, there's no difference whatsoever. They're the same thing, okay? Those three safety rules still fall into play no matter what you're handling. For that matter, if you're using a shotgun, you're using a rifle, you're using any firearm whatsoever, you're using a bow, you're using a crossbow, a BB gun, those safety rules are in effect for all of those items. And, you know, bear in mind, if any one of those items gets pointed at a person and the projectile is released, the person's going to be hurting. And so safety is the most important thing when you're dealing with any weapon. As to differences in revolvers and semi-automatics, basically a revolver holds cartridges in a cylinder, normally six, however it goes anywhere from 5 to 10, depending on the revolver. So if you see that one in the movies where they shoot 9 shots out of it, well, nowadays they actually make them that do that. Probably when they made that movie, they didn't. But and actually, that's not really true either. Many years ago, there was a revolver called a Le Fachot made in France that was 20 shots. So there are multiple different types, and the standard 6-shot cylinder is not always what you would see. That is the normal. Most of them are going to have that. Anyway, it holds the 6 rounds, the 6 cartridges in that cylinder, or however many it is in the cylinder, and as you pull the trigger, that rotates, and each time it comes up with a new round and fires it as the hammer falls. With a semi-automatic, you have a magazine which holds the bullets in the magazine, and as you squeeze the trigger, the empty one ejects, and the slide, which is the top of the handgun, goes backwards, ejecting that empty cartridge, and as it comes forward, it picks up the next live round and puts it in the single chamber where it'll then be fired.
Okay, well, that's a good description of them. Thank you very much. Now, let's go a little deeper here. Now, we talked about the gun being unloaded and loading. Okay, what other safety precautions beyond the basics should we know? We know the difference between a revolver and a semi-automatic now, but we know there's no difference in the way to handle them. So what should we know beyond the basics of safety?
Well, there's a few things to bear in mind, and we'll split the two guns up for a minute. Revolvers don't have safeties. There's no safety on a revolver. The safety on a revolver is what I spoke about earlier, the trigger finger and your mind. Those are the two safeties on a revolver. Now, modern revolvers, if you drop the gun on the ground, it's not going to go bang. However, if you're handling an old-style revolver, like the old Western-style revolvers that John Wayne used and other Western action heroes, you know, those are not safe to have six rounds in them, because when you drop those on the hammer, if there is a cartridge under the hammer ready to go, it will go bang. Okay, so if you're dealing with older guns like that, it's something you want to check out with a semi-automatic. You know, all semi-automatics have things called safeties. Now, you have to bear in mind that a safety on a gun is a mechanical device. Now, our cars are mechanical devices, and we know very well that they fail. Mm-hmm. Well, mechanical devices can fail. So, again, we're on to that subject of what were the two items that I spoke about that are always the things to think about with safety. It's your finger, trigger finger. If it's not on the trigger, it can't go bang. And your mind. Remember to always keep it pointed in that safe direction. 99% of the time, the safeties on a semi-automatic will work. But for that 1% of time, what are we going to do? We're going to keep it pointed in the safe direction so that just in case of that scenario where the safety does not work, we're not going to hurt anybody.
Very good. All right? Let me ask you one thing about revolvers for a second, going back to them. The double action revolver, do you not consider that a safety measure, having the double?
Well, there's two styles of action. There's a single action and a double action. The difference between single action and double action is the relationship of the trigger to the hammer. If the trigger can perform two actions, and that's cocking the hammer and then releasing the hammer, it's a double action. If the trigger can only perform one action, and that would be releasing the hammer, it is a single action. Single action is the Old West style. Double action is a modern revolver. And no, it's not a safety, because with a double action, you pick the gun up, you pull the trigger, it goes bang. That's double action. You pull the trigger, it cocks the hammer, and then releases the hammer and goes bang. Now, with a single action, that's almost more of a safety than the double action, because you actually have to cock the hammer first before you can squeeze the trigger. So, in actuality, the single action, unless it's an old style where it's not safe to have that cartridge under the hammer, the single action would be safer than a double action in that sense.
Very good. Thanks, Eric. All right. Now, you see the guns have ammo. Let's talk about ammo a little bit. Now, ammunition is usually stamped on the side of the barrel of the gun. So we know what type of ammunition to use in our guns, all right? But how do we identify the correct ammunition?
Okay. First off, on a revolver, the barrel on the side of the barrel is normally stamped, as you mentioned, with the caliber and the cartridge that it uses. In a semi-automatic, that stamp is normally on the barrel itself, on the chamber part of the barrel, which is the part you see where the cartridge case would eject. The ammunition, all modern ammunition, and we're not talking about military ammunition, military surplus ammunition, we'll go into that in just a minute, but normal modern ammunition has a thing called a head stamp on it. And the head stamp is not in the place where you'd think. It's on the bottom of the cartridge, not on the top of it. So on the bottom of the cartridge, when you flip it over, on that head stamp, it's going to tell you who the manufacturer is. So, for example, let's say it's manufactured by Federal Cartridge Company. It's going to say Fed on it or Federal on it, and then it's going to tell you the actual cartridge that it is, such as 357 Mag or 45 ACP, which is 45 automatic center fire pistol. So you need to match the designation on the head stamp of the cartridge with the designation on the side of your barrel. And with limited changes to this statement. One gun will only shoot one type of ammunition. That's the way it is. Okay. However, there are a couple exceptions to the rule. For example, the .357 Magnum will also shoot the .38 Special cartridge. The .44 Magnum will shoot the .44 Special cartridge. There's a few other examples of that out there, but for the most part, the general cartridges that most people will be will deal with, the .357 Magnum and the .44 Magnum are the two that you're going to deal with that will also shoot a different cartridge. Now, that other cartridge is the exact same diameter. The only difference is the case, the brass case itself is a little bit shorter and has a little bit less powder in it. So it's lighter recoiling. It would be a nicer round to shoot for target shooting to practice with the gun. If you're shooting a .357 Magnum, it has a fairly sharp recoil, and you know, you're certainly going to know it when you shoot it. However, if you shoot .38 Specials out of it, it's much softer, it's much easier to handle, it's much better for accurate target shooting.
Oh, very good. Thanks, Eric. All right, so let me just ask you one quick question. Can you put the wrong ammunition in the gun, in a different gun?
Yes, you can. Absolutely. And this is one of the main reasons why you have to be certain that you're putting the right ammunition in the gun, because when you fire a cartridge, it has rapid expansion. And the correct cartridge fits the cylinder properly, so that, or the chamber properly, so that it's not going to hurt the gun. If you have rapid expansion in a cartridge that doesn't fit the chamber properly, it could actually blow the gun up.
Well, that's good to know then. This is N1SZ Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum. And with that answer, let me take a break here and open up the floor again for any questions or comments that you may have for Eric or Nancy about anything we've covered or any questions you have about guns. So come on aboard with your suffix only, please.
Allie, my Charlie Bravo.
Lima Charlie Bravo. George, welcome aboard tonight, and come on aboard and ask your question.
Well, thank you, Susan, and thank Eric and his bride for doing the show this evening. Eric, your preference as far as a revolver or a semi-automatic there. I do like a revolver, you know, as you get into the safety. When I do bring it in the house, I usually will take one cartridge out and leave that in the open slot there, just in case, you know, it should drop. And this one here also has a lock on the trigger, a little old screw, use an Allen wrench, you could lock it that way, but you know, that takes too long to fiddle with that. But so I'll leave a empty hole. But I was wondering about semi-automatic, even with their locking devices, a drop on the floor, if you had one chambered, you know, it seemed like, you know, it could, might want to cause you to do a dance in a hurry.
Hey, George, how you doing? Nice to meet you tonight. Well, I can answer that in a couple of different ways, but my personal preference is a semi-automatic, but I shoot an awful lot. When I teach my classes, I always tell people that if you're not going to be able to practice with the gun more than at least a couple times a month consistently, you should probably use a revolver. Because as we spoke about, you know, pretty much a revolver, if you pull the trigger and it doesn't go bang, you can pull the trigger again and it goes bang. With a semi-automatic, if you pull the trigger and it doesn't go bang, there's a lot of things you have to do before it can go bang again. And if the guy on the other side who's coming at you has one too, then you're in trouble. So for that, certainly a revolver is the best way to go. Now, your revolver specifically, you know, without you giving me a model, a specific model and manufacturer, it's hard for me to answer it precisely, but I'm going to guess, since it sounds like a modern revolver, since it has that lock on it that you were talking about, and recently, that's something that's come into effect recently. It hasn't, within the last 10 years or so that manufacturers have been doing that. I'm going to guess that it's a modern revolver. And along with that guess, I'm going to say that there's basically no modern revolver that you can drop on the floor and have it go bang. They're all designed so that they have that the hammer will not fall and hit the firing pin unless you have the trigger held completely to the rear, as in pulling the trigger. So if you were to, you could pretty much throw it on a cement ground, a cement walk, and have a truck drive over it, and it wouldn't go bang.
Well, thank you, sir. And we are neighbors of Gordon. Live within a few miles of each other there. And what can I say? It's a wonderful day in the neighborhood, nice and warm this morning, and it should get cold toward the weekend. But appreciate it there. And yeah, I did used to have a Charter Arms, the Bulldog there, and it was a gift from the sister. Love the gun. It's a lot of bang for that little gun, but sometimes you need what you need there. Appreciate you doing it. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo, and who knows, we might come up with something else.
Yeah, George, that I would have guessed either Charter Arms or Taurus, and since you brought that up, that gun is most definitely, that is a modern manufacturer. I know the exact gun. I have actually the old version of that gun from maybe 25 years ago, and even that one, the old original Charter Bulldog, I could throw it on the ground and it won't go bang. So you're safe loading that right up, and that way if you need it, it's there and it's ready to roll, and you've got as many shots as you can get.
All right, well, thanks, George, for your question. And, yeah, by all means, come on back here and ask away and make your comments as well, because they're always enlightening. And especially you, where you live, you have a lot of family and animals in your house, and safety is probably a priority in your house when it comes to the guns, too. So let me break with you, and let me go a little further in gun safety here. Now, we know the fundamentals of gun safety, and you touched on beyond the basics, and that included learning how to operate a gun. Eric, can you talk about the safe operation of a gun? Now, what do we need to know to operate a gun?
Put the ammunition in and pull the trigger? Well, obviously a little bit more than that. You know, to be honest with you, the safe operation of the gun is really something for the classroom. I mean, we're getting into almost a full NRA class here if we go that deep. Every gun, the most important thing to learn that we can throw out there in our short period of time here is that every single gun is different. Every single gun has a different set of rules. When we talk about, let's say, semi-automatics, there's single-action semi-automatics and double-action semi-automatics, just like there are with revolvers. So again, single-action, you have to cock the hammer first, and then it can be released by the trigger. Double-action, you can cock and release the hammer with the trigger. Now, with most double-action semi-automatics, there's a thing called a decocker. You push what looks like a safety, you push it down, and it decocks the hammer. That's a safe way to decock the hammer because it's designed to do that. With most single-action semi-automatics, it's never safe to decock the gun with a live round in the chamber. Empty the gun first, and then you're safe to lower the hammer on it on what you know is an empty chamber. You check the chamber, you've got your magazine out of the gun, and oh, while we're on that subject, let me throw this out there. A lot of people call them clips, not magazines, but there is a difference. A magazine is a box, and inside that box is a spring with a thing called a follower. And when you put the bullets in that box, it pushes the follower down on the spring. And it holds however it holds. You know, the magazines hold anywhere from 6 to 35 or so, depending on the gun. A clip is a U-shaped piece of metal that just holds the bullets in it, and the whole thing goes into the gun, or it feeds them into the gun from the outside. So when you go to the store and the guy behind the counter says, oh, yeah, it comes with two clips, you can ask him if it comes with two magazines, not clips.
Oh, very good. And should we trust that guy selling us the guns who refers to it as clips?
Probably not.
There you go. All right. And all right, so we don't really want to get into how to, really use the gun that way, how to operate it.
Yeah, the problem again is that even with revolvers, for example, there's when you're dealing with a double action revolver, there's a release on the side of every revolver that releases, it's a button or a slide that releases the cylinder out so you can push it out the side of the gun and you can load it or unload it. There's three different types of those that are used, actually four. One pushes forward, one pushes back or pulls backwards, one's a button you push in, one's a button you push down. So without having the guns in hand, it's very difficult to say, okay, this is how you do it.
Right.
You know, and again, the same thing with semi-automatics. There's so many different controls on semi-automatics, and by controls I mean the safety, the slide lock or the slide release. That's something that when the slide comes back, it'll lock it open if there's no ammunition left. The magazine release button, some of them are on the bottom of the grip, some of them are on the side near the trigger guard, some of them are part of the trigger guard. You know, there's so many different controls on the different guns that it's very difficult to in this broadcast to make a broad statement and say this is how you should handle every gun, because you can't. They're all different. It's an important thing would be to be certain that when you do go through a class or when you do decide to purchase your gun, that you understand all the controls on the gun. And the guy behind the counter should be talking to you about that if you ask. You know, go up to him. And, you know, most people in gun shops are friendly and love to give out knowledge, like me sitting here. I love to give out my knowledge. And I'd love to sit down with you and show you 25 different guns and teach you about every one of them. And so most of the time does the guy behind the counter. You know, most people who work at gun shops do it because they love it. So by loving it, they generally know about all the guns they have in the shop, and they want to show you about it.
Right. That's cool. And so now, would you recommend you really should go through a gun safety course. You would recommend that.
I would highly recommend a gun safety class. I honestly don't know how many states require it. You know, Connecticut requires it to attain a handgun carry permit. And in the state of Connecticut, if you do not have a handgun carry permit, you can't even purchase a handgun. There are a lot of other states that don't require that. However, I'm certain that you can find an NRA instructor in any state. And I would highly recommend, you know, if you want to involve yourself in the sport, to most definitely take a class to learn about the different guns. And, you know, in the class you will learn quite a bit, I can almost guarantee that, unless you've been shooting for a lot of years already.
Very good. And you probably would recommend waiting to purchase a gun until you go through the class to actually figure out what you like or what you can, you know, shoot best or feel good in your hands. How do you pick out a gun for a person?
Well, it is helpful to go through the class. There's no doubt about it. But when you decide to purchase a gun, and, you know, the one thing that I'm going to tell you is I don't pick out a gun for somebody. I'll never pick out a gun for somebody. And the reason behind that is every gun feels different in everybody's hand. You need to go to the gun store. You need to handle it as though you're going to shoot it. You know, pick it up with a proper grip. You know, what's very important when you're actually shooting is to have a proper grip, to know how to look at the sights correctly, because there's many different ways to look at the sights, and if you're not looking at them the right way, you're not going to hit the target well. And these things, sometimes you'll pick up a handgun and you'll bring it up as though you're going to shoot it and you won't even be able to see the sights. Other times you might be able to pick up the handgun and when you bring it up as though you're going to shoot it, the sights are right there in line, perfect for you, it feels great in your hand. Well, that's the one to start looking at. That's the one to go, hey, I think I want something like this because this feels real good to me. You should pick up and handle as many handguns as you possibly can before you decide to purchase, because every grip feels different. There's fatter ones, there's thinner ones, there's rounder ones, there's, you know, there's 150 different styles. And you absolutely should handle as many as you can before you decide on what exactly you want to purchase. There are other things to think about when you're purchasing too. You know, is the gun going to be used for target shooting? Is the gun going to be used for protection? What's my dollar limit? You know, you got to take all these things into account. What caliber would I like? My recommendation is always to buy a .22. And the reason behind that is .22 ammunition is very inexpensive. so you can shoot a lot of it and you can get a lot of practice in and do it fairly inexpensively, the least expensive that you can do for shooting, okay? 22s are also inherently accurate, so they're going to help you get better at accurate shooting and practice. And they're very light in recoil and low noise level. And speaking of noise, doesn't matter what you shoot. And to be honest with you, even with modern air rifles, you always, always need to wear hearing protection and eye protection, because you can always have a ricochet that'll come back. I've actually been hit by ricochets numerous times. So it absolutely can happen. So eye protection, ear protection, and I always recommend a 22.
Excellent. And it's good that you say that, to try a lot of guns. I know my first purchase of a gun, when I went into the gun store, was they recommended the Lady Smith & Wesson because I was a lady. And, of course, not really knowing much about that, and Nancy's shaking her head, too, because as women, there was one time, and not always now, that they just handed us what they thought was the woman's gun.
Mm-hmm.
But, I went to target practice with that gun and couldn't hit a thing with it because it was just too light, and I couldn't really control it that well because it was too light. But now, after trying a lot of different weapons, I have a much heavier and nicer gun. And Nancy has the same gun, which is like kind of funny. It's just what we've done. But, yeah, there's a lot of prejudice for women out there for a while.
Well, Nancy, what was your first gun?
A .22 revolver.
See?
There you go.
Seriously, though, I think, you know, in the shooting industry, it always was a man thing, you know. There's that testosterone thing. To be honest with you, I'd say 99% of the women in my classes outshoot the men in my classes by the end of the class, and a lot of that has to do with the testosterone thing. You know, men, we know what we're doing. You can't teach me anything. What are you talking about? You know, and then when they get shown up at the end of the class by the women, they start thinking about what they're doing.
There
you go. But I'm a firm believer, as we've come forward in time and whatnot, that, you know, first off, a lot of the old-timers in the sport realize that if we don't expand the sport to other people, we have a much larger chance of losing the sport. And, you know, because of that, there's a lot more openness to women joining in the sport. You know, as well as things like, and this doesn't have anything to do with handguns, but, you know, when a pretty little girl goes to the Olympics from the United States and wins gold in shotgun, you know, you got to start thinking about it. So along those lines, the club that Nancy and I belong to, we do a yearly Women's Day. Last year we had 40 women there, you know, and it's a day-long shoot where we go through a short NRA class. It's a shortened NRA class, and then we spend time in the range shooting as much as we can, both rifles and handguns.
Very good. Okay, well, let me open up to the floor here. I think we have somebody who has a comment. WB2LOU has a comment. Ted, come on aboard and ask Eric or Nancy your question.
Well, I really don't have a question, but this is Ted, WB2LOU, temporarily in our winter location here in Central Florida, where we're enjoying the nice weather. But anyway, the couple of comments I want to make here is that when I took the gun safety training, our state police officer, who was one of the assistant instructors, pointed out one thing that I felt was very, very important, and I have tried to follow it very, very closely. And his point was that when you squeeze the trigger, and that round comes out the end of the barrel, it is followed by two additional things. The first thing is that there could be a very serious moral obligation following that bullet. And the third thing, the second thing that comes out of there after the bullet, is that there could easily be an attorney behind it. So one has to be very, very careful, regardless of what the castle laws are in your respective state or location. The second comment I have about all this is that, based on what I've learned, my opinion is that you should not be allowed to purchase a gun without having taken the gun safety training. I think that has to come first. That's the way they do it in Ohio. I also believe they do it possibly in Maryland, and I think that's also in Connecticut as well. There's very few states that require that, but I think it's important to require it. With that, that's my comments for this evening. Back to Suzanne there. This is WB2LEO.
Well, thanks, Ted, for the comments, and very well noted, because I also agree, and I have to, Eric and Nancy were just shaking their heads, that everyone should go through that safety course before they're allowed to buy a gun for the safety of not only themselves but other people. And let me hand it back to Eric. I think he has a follow-up comment.
Yeah, I'd like to throw one or two things out there, and I do most definitely agree that no one should be able to purchase a handgun without at least an NRA safety class. You know, just to learn the basics, if nothing else, before they jump into doing it, you know. And to follow up with what you said before, you know, you may not be criminally prosecuted if you use a gun to defend yourself. However, criminal and civil are two different things. You can always be civilly prosecuted, which means that they can try and take everything you own from you. And, you know, even if they lose, you're going to pay for a lawyer. You're going to spend the anguish and the time involved in dealing with it, and, you know, the change in your life. And as to the moral side of it, you know, that is a personal decision that has to be made by everybody. You know, I throw that out there even with hunting. You know, I am a hunter. However, I will never, ever push my views on anybody, because it's a personal decision. It's most definitely something that each person needs to decide for themselves, and this includes self-defense. If you don't feel that you can deal with that moral obligation, then you need to decide how you want to handle it yourself. And you know, so I'm basically in 100% agreement with you there, Ted. Thanks for coming on board.
And this is N1SUZ Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum. And while we're at a break here for a moment, let me throw it back to the floor and see if anyone else has any comments or questions for Eric or Nancy about gun safety or guns in general. If you do, please come aboard now with your suffix only, please.
Six, Victor.
Well, welcome back, Gordon. Come on aboard.
Yeah, I want to welcome Lou back in, too. It's been a while, Lou. Glad to hear that you're down here in Florida and enjoying yourself, I hope. Hope you brought a lot of money. You know, we love the snowbirds coming down this way. I enjoyed your comment, Eric, about pick up and feel look for what feels right for you when you're picking up a gun. I happen to be a guitar player, and that's exactly the same saying that we tell our students and people that we're associated with. We're not going to recommend a guitar for you. You go out and pick one off the shelf and play it. If you like it, buy it. If you don't, keep playing all the rest of them until you find one that you like. My question to you, Eric, is what would be your recommendation for an average person that wants to get a carry permit? What gun would you recommend? And you've already said the 22. I'm not sure that I'm buying that yet, but you know, something that is not bulky, that they can carry a woman in her purse, or a man on his side, or you know, the ankle holster, or whatever. What caliber would you recommend? And I realize that Clint Eastwood's 44 is probably not amongst your suggestions. Eric, please, over.
Oh, come on. We can't offer the 44 Magnum up on this one? Gosh darn it. and no, I definitely was not offering the 22 long rifle up as a carry gun. Really, you know, there's an old saying that the gun you have on you is better than the gun you left at home. So if it happens to be a 22 long rifle and you run into that situation where you need to use it, then it's better than having nothing at all. But it certainly is by no means what I would recommend as a defensive handgun. You know, there's a number of things to consider with what you stated. And again, I'm going to go back to the statement I made earlier, which was, how often are you going to practice with the gun? If you're going to practice with the gun a couple of times a month, you're going to get used to it, you're going to try some different ammunition in it to be certain that it feeds well and functions well, then a semi-automatic is not a bad choice. If you want to, if you don't have, you know, if you want to carry a lighter gun, is where I'm going, you know, there are a lot of small 9mm that conceal very well. Ruger makes one. Kel-Tec, right out of Florida, makes one. There's a couple others out there. On the revolver side, and again, I would go with a revolver if you're not going to be able to have as much practice as you should if you're going to carry a semi-automatic. When I go with a revolver, and on that side, you know, there's Smith & Wesson, there's Taurus, there's the Charter Arms. The new Charter Arms stuff is pretty good. I think it was George who mentioned he had one. That's a great little handgun now. And Colt, of course. So those are the big names. And all of those are excellent. I would recommend a 38 Special or a 357 Magnum, whichever one is more comfortable to you when you handle it. Again, the 357 Magnum, of course, will shoot the 38 Special as well. So you have the options there. It's a little bit more versatile for you. If you decide you can handle the recoil of the 357, then, of course, that's the best round that you could use for defense. If you're not comfortable with the recoil, you can always go with the 38 Special, and it's still a good defensive round. I mean, bear in mind, you know, the police departments in the United States used the 357 Magnum for 35, 40 years until they all got into the semi-automatics.
Yeah, roger on that, Eric. Thank you. Let me make sure I've got it. Sounds like it. Well, I was looking at particularly the bang for the, you know, the punch and the weight and the size, the comfortability of carrying it. I've had a 38 Special 5 in the chamber as opposed to the normal 6. Worked very well, was very comfortable to handle and carry. I'll tell you a quick story that you'll probably appreciate. I don't know about the rest of the people, but when I first got my 357 Magnum, I'm retired out of the television business, Eric, and I was out at the transmitter site just shortly after getting this particular gun, and we had a cable reel. Now, the guy wires off of a 2,000-foot tower are 9 pounds a foot and 2 inches in diameter, and they roll them up on reels before they put them up on the tower. I had a cable reel out there, and each side of the cable, empty cable reel, was probably 2 inches or maybe a little thicker on each side. And I pumped two 38 Specials into that thing, and it embedded itself on the closest reel side to me. I pumped two 357s in it. It went through the closest side of the reel to me, went out of the other side of the reel, and ended up on the 110 acres someplace that we had. What a difference, sir. Over.
Oh, yeah, there's a definite difference to be seen in those. You know, obviously, as you noted, quite a bit more power in a 357 Magnum. But, of course, correspondingly, you know, as physics dictates, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So along with that more power you have on the front end, you're going to get quite a bit more recoil on the back end. And, you know, so for some people, the 38 Special really is a better cartridge to use just because of the, there's some people who are actually recoil sensitive and, you know, can acquire a flinch from shooting a big 357 Magnum too often. And again, that's another reason why I always recommend to at least own a 22 for practice, because the recoil is so light and the sound is so light and it's so easy to shoot a 22. It's much easier to practice good handgun shooting or good proper grip and proper sight picture and whatnot with a 22, and then get back to the basics with it.
And I have to add here too, for anybody who hasn't shot any 357s, that it is an amazing difference between the 380 cartridge and the 357, which I put in my 357 Magnum once and only once, and after the recoil I took those other 357s out of the revolver and put the 38s back in. With that, let me break with you, Gordon, and let me open the floor again for any comments or questions that we have for Eric or Nancy tonight. If you've got anything you want to share or got a question, please come aboard now with your suffix only, please. All right. I guess we have a little quiet audience now here. They're all mesmerized by you guys. Okay. Well, we're talking about gun safety, and we're talking about guns. One thing that I think we should talk about is about cleaning the guns. I'm sure that one part of having a safe gun is having a clean gun. Is that right, Eric and Nancy?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, anytime you use a gun, go to the range of practice, you should clean the gun. You know, and since we're talking about safety, the most important thing is to never have any ammunition anywhere near the gun when you're cleaning it. You know, there's that thing, the phone rings and you walk out of the room to grab it and somebody else walks in and loads it because the ammunition is sitting right there, and you come back and pull the trigger and it goes bang. So most definitely when you're cleaning a gun, you want no ammunition near it. You want to make sure if it's a semi-automatic, the magazine is out and you've checked the chamber and you know that it's completely empty and the magazine is empty as well. If it's a revolver, you want to open that cylinder up and check all the chambers and make sure they're all empty before you even start cleaning the gun. But definitely, you know, a clean gun, a maintained gun, is going to perform better. It's going to last longer. While we're on that subject, there's two normal finishes on guns. There's bluing and there's stainless steel. Those are the standards. There's a lot of others now because the military stuff is big, and so you got some other finishes that are pretty impervious. But basically, there's blue steel and stainless steel. Blue steel rusts much easier, so you need to keep a light coat of oil on it. Bear in mind, though, stainless steel only stains less. Doesn't mean it can't rust, and it can't also, you know, become out of in disrepair if you're not caring for it. So anytime you use it, you want to clean it. And, you know, the proper cleaning kits, you can buy them at any gun store, and they have instructions right in them. And, again, without going into the depth of that, which you would go into if you took the class, you take a class, they do go into cleaning, and you would learn exactly how to clean the guns that you would be handling.
Okay, and can you think of anything off the top of your head that would be a cause with a not clean gun? I mean, is there problems that specifically happen without cleaning your gun?
Yeah, you can definitely get into problems without cleaning your gun. The biggest thing that would happen, or the most dangerous thing, would be an obstruction in the barrel. If there's any sort of obstruction in the barrel and you fire the gun, it's very possible that you're going to blow the gun apart. You know, I've seen it happen. I have a barrel that I use in my classes that was actually blown apart. It wasn't obstruction in the barrel. It wasn't because of cleaning. It was from what they call a squib load. Now, a squib load is a cartridge that produces less power or velocity than normal. And unfortunately, when that happens, sometimes the bullet can actually lodge in the barrel. And if you pull the trigger again, another bullet is going to travel down the barrel and hit the first bullet. And so the barrel that I have at home is actually blown apart from one bullet hitting another bullet. in the barrel. Fortunately for the person who had it, they were wearing eye protection and ear protection, and you get a much bigger boom out of it when that happens. But they were wearing eye protection and ear protection, and nothing came back and hurt them in any way. It can happen, though. You could get seriously hurt from that situation. So you always want to make sure that your barrel is clear of any obstructions. That's the most important.
Okay, and since you mentioned the ammunition again, let me ask you if there's any ammunition we should stay away from. We know the correct ammunition we need to put in our guns now, but is there any special type? I mean, we know there's reloads. Are reloads, you know, safe, or does it depend on who does the reloading, or what type of ammo should we avoid?
Okay, yeah, there are definitely reloads. You know, any ammunition from a national manufacturer, such as Winchester or Remington, Federal, any of those ammunitions are excellent ammunition. The ammunition that I would stay away from, unless you're a real collector or a larger enthusiast in the gun sport, otherwise I would stay away from things like surplus military ammunition. I would stay away from Russian ammunition, which uses different metals in the cases. They use steel cases instead of brass cases, and that can be an issue in some guns. There's also some ammunition that's manufactured with aluminum cases, and it's once fireable ammunition. You cannot reload it. In normal brass ammunition, you can reload. The private person can actually reload it in their home. And that brings out a whole other safety part of shooting, and is something that if you got involved in the sport and you decided you wanted to reload, and there are many good reasons to reload, probably the best reason is that the cost. You know, a box of 45 ACP ammunition of 50 rounds is about $35 a box. But if I reload them, it's going to cost me about $12 a box. So there's a large savings if you're going to do a lot of shooting to reloading. If you're going to reload, the NRA also gives a class on reloading. I highly recommend you talk to somebody. Either you talk to an instructor who can give you the class, or you at the least speak with somebody who's knowledgeable in it and can give you a start of what to do and how to do it properly, because it is very important when you're reloading to make certain that you do it properly. I was going to throw one more thing in there, and this has to do with anything that has to do with guns, and that is if you're reloading, if you're shooting, if you're holding the gun, no alcohol, no drugs. And very important when you're reloading, obviously, because if the alcohol makes you miss something, now you could have an issue when you're actually shooting the ammunition. But obviously, your judgment is impaired no matter how much alcohol you've had and no matter what drugs you're on, be them prescription drugs or, you know, that are legally yours, or illegal drugs. Either way, your judgment is impaired, and you should never be doing anything anywhere near guns at that point in time.
All right, thanks, Eric. This is N1SUZ, Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum, and we've got Eric and Nancy Shanahan here talking about gun safety. So let me break here for a moment and open up the floor again and see if anyone has any additional comments or questions about gun safety or anything they want to mention. So if you do, if you have a comment, please come aboard now with your suffix only, please.
Hey, my Charlie Bravo.
Be a KD.
Okay, the net recognizes George, LCB, and Jim, WKD. First, let's go to George. George, come on aboard.
Thank you, Sue. Good evening, Jim. Eric, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about splitting barrels. Not as common as it used to be, but, old revolvers, a little bit of play in the cylinder could cause a little bit of lead to get in the fingertips. Maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, that would be, you're talking about the lockup of the cylinder and on a revolver. And, you know, if you're purchasing used, and it's older used, not a modern manufacturer used, it's definitely something, if you're not fully knowledgeable in it, you would want to have somebody who is take a look at it, whether it be a gunsmith or, you know, if you trust the store that you're purchasing at and you talk to them and they can show you the amount of play that's in it. an awful lot of revolvers, you could get into that situation where they'll shave a little bit of metal off, a little bit of lead off when you're firing them. And generally speaking, you know, you're not going to get anything coming back at you. If you do, we're going to fall back on that thing where always wear eye protection and ear protection. Now, obviously, if you're using it for defense, you're not going to be able to have that opportunity to put on the eye protection and ear protection. But if you're using it for defense, to be very honest with you, buy something new. You know, modern manufacturer gives you the peace of mind that it's a firearm that's going to work when you need it to work. And that, if you're using it for defense, is the most important, obviously.
Well, thank you, sir. Yeah, and, you know, it all comes back to the basic, you know, like you said, finding the weapon that you're comfortable with, learning that weapon, what it can do and what it can't do, and then learning yourself as to what you cause an action to be to follow it out, because at that moment it's no time to get all wobbly kneed or loose or something like that. I mean, and I do realize in every situation you will get the opportunity to do what you have to do at that time. So long as everything's together, you'll be with us one more day. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo.
Well, thanks very much, George. And thanks for the question, too. It's a good question. And we welcome those tonight because we got the experts here tonight. And we're going to drill them as much as we can before they go home. So let me break with you, George, and let me welcome Jim aboard. Jim, come on aboard. KJ4 WKD. Okay, Jim, I'm going to try one more time. Maybe your audio isn't on. Jim, are you there? This is N1SUZ to KJ4 WKD.
Hi, Suzanne. Jim, KJ4 WKD. I've got some internet difficulties or some echo link difficulties, and it's not any drop any time. Anyway, am I being heard? And if so, I'll continue.
Sure enough, Jim, we got your audio here. Come on aboard.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there's a time delay, and there's no time in between your calling for check-ins or calling for me on my end. So that's a technical problem. But anyway, I wanted to comment that I've only bought one box of aluminum hull ammo, and it jammed my gun every time, so no more of that. But I do have a couple of questions. Well, one, I guess. I have a 357, I guess you'd call it a snubby, small gun. Now, I'm okay with a recoil with 357 ammo, but I'm thinking firing in a self-defense posture at night in low light. You know, the 357 is one heck of a muzzle flash and a big recoil. I guess my question would have to do with, or would be, 38s, what I would call hot 38s, are 357, maybe JHPs, or what would you recommend, say, in a expected self-defense situation, maybe in low light at night, Eric or Nancy?
Hi, Jim. Glad you could come aboard. Well, I got to be honest with you, with a short-barreled revolver, you're going to get a muzzle flash no matter what you use, so the nighttime situation is going to be difficult, and that's the same with any handgun. You're pretty much going to get a flash out of the end of the muzzle. What that comes from is that, you know, when you fire a gun, the powder that's in the cartridge case burns. It doesn't explode, and it creates a gas, and the gases that it creates are what are actually pushing the bullet down the barrel. The muzzle flash that you see is unburned powder burning after the bullet has left the barrel. So depending on barrel length and what powders the manufacturers use, that can be minimized to some degree, but with a short barrel revolver, you're never going to get rid of it. Now, there are some other considerations to think about, though. Number one would be time back on target. And by that I mean is when you're shooting a short barrel revolver like that in a 357, your recoil is pretty sharp. Whether you're comfortable with it or not, your recoil is still pretty sharp, and it's going to raise the muzzle pretty high. If you're shooting 38s, the muzzle and the recoil and the muzzle height is going to be quite a bit less, and you're going to be back on the target much quicker. And, you know, in a defensive situation, you really want to be back on target as fast as you can because you don't know what each shot is going to do. And when you're in that situation where you've got the muzzle flash, now you want to be back on the target most definitely as fast as you can and hopefully get your sight back before, you know, anything untoward happens to yourself. Personally, and I do occasionally carry a 38 special, a 5-shot 38 special snubby. I don't have the option of putting 357s in it, but if I did have that option, I would still be shooting 38 specials out of it. You know, there's a number of good jacketed hollow point rounds, JHPs as you call them, 125 grain jacketed hollow points out of a 38 special. There's a lot of manufacturers out there that do them. You know, you can pretty much pick almost any one you want because the modern bullets that they're making now for defensive use are just excellent for what they're designed for. And in a 38, again, I use 125 grain jacketed hollow points. If you wanted a little bit more oomph, you could go with what they call plus P rounds. That would be the hotter ones that you're talking about. It should say plus P on the box after it. It would be 38 special plus P. There's also plus P plus. You may or may not be able to purchase those. In some states, they're limited to law enforcement only. So you do have options, and even in the 38 special plus P or plus P plus, you're going to have quite a bit less recoil than the 357 Magnum and a little bit less muzzle flash, a little better controllability of the handgun. I would definitely recommend that over the 357. Generally speaking, I would keep the 357s for if you had a 4-inch or a 6-inch 357 Magnum that you're using. Then you've got a little bit more gun to be able to actually control the recoil.
Well, thank you, Eric. Yeah, I had the same thinking. I do have a 4-inch barrel Smith 357 as well, and but the short one, and I'm more concerned about the recoil because you really can't hold that gun down, really either one of them, but the small one especially, and I go with the 38s. It's just you'd rather have more control over the weapon than have and give up a little punch, so... That does me, Eric. Thank you, sir, and thank you for joining us tonight. I just got in, just got out of town, just got into the program, so sounds great. I want to hear the recording later. Back to you, Susie. Thank you. KJ4WKD, back to Net Control N1SUC.
Well, thanks, Jim, and I'll break with you, and thanks for that question because it was a really good one, and Eric's been preparing for that question all evening. I wonder why. And so now let me break with you and let me see if anybody else has any questions or comments while we were talking about all this stuff. If anybody else would like to make some comments or come in with a question for Eric or Nancy, come on aboard now with your suffix only, please. Okay. Now that we've talked about gun safety and ammunition and all this other stuff and cleaning the gun, how do we store a gun? How do we transport one? Let's talk a little bit about that. You were telling us about that great clock radio you have at home, and now I want to hear a little bit more about safe ways to carry our guns with us.
Well, let's start with in the home first. You know, we talked about the clock radio that's actually a steel-encased box that you can have next to your bed so that you can keep a loaded gun much safer, especially if you have children in the home. But, you know, the most important thing if you decide to get into the sport is to once you've purchased a few guns and you're getting towards the direction of having a few in the home, is to have some sort of larger safe storage. We have a couple of large safes in the house. There's you know, even to go to the point of saying there's steel boxes that you can buy from Walmart fairly inexpensively that have the round key locks on them, and you can bolt those into a closet, and you know, that way there's no possible way that anybody unauthorized is going to have access to that. You know, that's what's most important is unauthorized means anybody, you know, you don't wish to have access to that gun. And nobody should have access to it without you being there. You know, that you're the controller of that weapon. You're the person who's responsible. You're the person who, if something happens with it, is going to be negligent. And there is, you know, that there are negligence rules or laws in many states. In Connecticut, there is. You know, if something happens with your gun in your home in Connecticut, you are responsible for that. You're the one they're going to take to court. You're the one that's going to end up in jail. You know, so you definitely want to be certain that when you're in the home, you've got it stored properly and safely. Obviously, there's many other ways to do that as well. There's trigger locks. There's barrel locks, which actually slide down the barrel and have a key lock. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but my recommendation always is to get yourself a safe. Again, the ones from even the ones from Walmart that are they're steel. I can't think what they call it. It's not sheet steel. It's thicker. You know, it's a little thicker, a little heavier duty, but they're not that expensive. You know, you can buy a reasonably sized safe like that for $150. You know, so it's worth that expense to make certain that nobody who you don't want to have access to it will have access to it.
And would you recommend a bolt-down safe as opposed to just a safe?
Well, any safe that you buy, any modern safe you buy is going to be designed to be able to be bolted down. And even the large gun safes have holes already in the base of them that are designed to be locked down to the floor, bolted into the floor.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter what ones you buy, you will be able to bolt it to a wall or the floor. As to transporting your guns, every state has different laws. So this is something I can only speak to you of Connecticut. You would need to know the laws in your state, and this is another reason to go to the class, you know, to learn the laws in your state. In Connecticut, you can't even purchase a handgun without a carry permit, which means you've gone through the NRA certification class and the whole nine yards, fingerprints and waiting time to get that. So when you're transporting it, you'd have your permit on you. Transporting it safely to and from a range, if you're not carrying the gun for defense, you want to put the gun in a box, you know, a standard carry case of some sort, ammunition separate from it. Those guns, anything you transport, basically shouldn't be easily accessible to the passenger in your car either. You know, it should be in the back, in the trunk. You know, if you have a truck in the back seat or under your seat or something like that, to keep it non-accessible to the passenger. As to carrying it on your side for defensive purposes, you know, we're going to go back to the same basic safety rules. You know your target. Know what's beyond your target and where the bullet may go if you miss your target. Keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to use it. Remember, the finger and the mind, those are the two safeties right there. Those are the two safeties that always work. The other safeties don't always work.
Well, let me ask you about carrying it, period. I in the movies, you got a guy sticking it, you know, in his back pocket or down in the back of his pants to hide it. What would you recommend for a holster?
Well, you know, a lot depends on how comfortable you want to be. There's many, many different ways to carry a gun. There are handbags for ladies that are designed with a pocket built into it that has a holster. There are attaché cases that there's ballistic nylon ones that have a special pocket for a handgun. They're briefcases. There's also fanny packs that are designed with a pocket in it for a handgun. As a matter of fact, anytime I see anybody when I'm out and about with a fanny pack, I just assume they're carrying a gun because it's that prevalent. Personally, I normally use a side holster, but that's assuming I can cover the gun. You know, in Connecticut, we are not required to have concealed carry. However, it's smart to have concealed carry. You really don't want to show everybody that you're carrying. And the police can annoy you. they can probably arrest you for breach of peace or, you know, fomenting, you know, yeah, turn me off because I don't know where I'm going with that one.
Talk about the police. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we're not going to get too far into law because I'm most definitely not a lawyer. But, you know, the most important thing is when you're carrying is to understand the laws in your state or in the state that you are carrying. If you go forward and you get a Florida permit, a lot of you guys are down there in Florida, if you get a Florida permit or if you get a Utah permit, and those are the two most reciprocal permits in the United States, they're both in the 33 to 35 state range that's reciprocal with them, understand that the rules and the laws that you're going to learn in the class only apply to the state in which the permit is being issued in. So the laws that we learned, we all went to a Utah pistol permit class this last Saturday, the laws we learned only applied to Utah. They didn't apply to the other 33 states that it's accepted in. So it's something you need to learn if you're going somewhere. You need to learn what the laws are in any state that you're going to be carrying in.
This is NY Massachusetts, Ed, and my name is Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum, and we've got Eric and Nancy Shanahan with us tonight talking about gun safety. So we just covered how to carry our weapons and the holsters and whatnot like that, and we just touched a bit on the law. Is there laws, besides the ones that we've talked about tonight, that you think we should know about? Is there anything that you can think of that you might want to share with us tonight?
Absolutely not. I really meant it when I said, you know, I'm far from being a lawyer. I enjoy my sport immensely, and I know basically what the laws and the rules are in the state of Connecticut, but it's too difficult to know all the laws in the states about it. However, there is a book you can look online, and there is a book with the laws of all 50 states about handguns. So you can purchase that for about $19 online. Just look up handgun laws, 50 state handgun laws, I believe. If you Google that, you'll come up with the book,
right.
And it's fairly inexpensive. And it's kept current so that, you know, what's been, any laws that have
right.
just come into effect
like
should
reference.
Be in there. Right, it's an excellent reference.
Or you can probably
book.
Look online, too, at each specific state with gun laws.
You can, absolutely.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks, Eric. Let me break here for a moment, and let me open up to the floor. We're winding down our gun safety talk tonight, and we're keeping Eric and Nancy here a little longer than they thought, but I told them they'd be here a little longer, too. So anyone else out here have any comments or questions, please come aboard now with your suffix only, please.
VQV.
6, Vector.
Okay, Net recognizes VQV, Chris out there in Pennsylvania, and Gordon, KY6V. Let me pick up Chris first. Welcome aboard, Chris. Nice to see you here tonight. Come on aboard with your question.
Well, thank you very much. KP3, Victor, Quebec Victor in Philadelphia. Name is Chris. Want to ask for a comment from Eric. My ex-wife is a nurse, and for Christmas, not this Christmas, but a year ago, she has a license to carry in the state of Pennsylvania, and we went out to our local gun shop looking for a weapon, and I bought for her a 357 Magnum, and originally she thought she wanted a Smith & Wesson, but then they had a Ruger, I believe it was a Ruger, and not only did she like it better the way it fit in her hand, but it was way, way less money, almost half. Have you noticed a correlation between how expensive a weapon is as opposed to the quality?
To some degree, yes, but a lot depends on the company itself that you're dealing with. Ruger makes excellent handguns. They're an outstanding company. They're one of the few left self-standing gun companies in the United States. You know, Smith & Wesson and trying to think of the, they just picked up another company, but Remington and a number of other companies, Winchester's owned out of Japan now, you know, a lot of the gun companies are no longer strictly U.S. owned or their own management. There's another management company actually owns them and is running them. Ruger's one of the few that actually is still owned by its own people and managed by its own people, and they make excellent guns. You know, it's a very difficult question to respond to, because a lot depends on what you're looking for. I would say that the Smith & Wesson would have been a slightly more polished handgun. Does that mean that it's going to last longer or shoot any better than the Ruger? No, absolutely not. Ruger makes an excellent gun as well. It's just maybe not quite as polished and quite as the little final touches that you get. And that's really what you're paying for when you're paying more money, is you're paying for those little extra touches. But, hey, you know, the Charter Arms, that we talked to George earlier, and he's got a Charter Arms, and you know what? I wouldn't put Charter Arms in the final finish category of a Ruger or a Smith or a Colt. It does the job, and it does it very well, and Charter Arms happens to be one of the other American companies that's still on its own. And they make a good solid product. Taurus, it's Brazilian, but their guns are basically copies of Smith & Wesson. They're not quite as polished. They're about half the cost. They're still an excellent gun. They shoot well. And, you know, again, it comes down to, for the most part, most modern handguns are decent guns. Most of the stuff that's out there, there's very, very few, if any, that I could pinpoint and say, boy, I wouldn't touch that gun with a 10-foot pole.
Well, thank you very much for that answer. And the rules in Pennsylvania, you need to get a permit just to buy a weapon to keep at home, and then there's a separate process if you have a need to actually carry. And because she's a nurse and works in some late night hours in some kind of not great places, she had no trouble getting that permit. But there are I wish she would take a class, because there are no requirements in Pennsylvania to take a class before you either buy a weapon or get a license to carry. This is KB3VQZ.
Yeah, I do agree with you 100% there. You know, there's a lot of things that the NRA does, you know, to try and keep the sport going. And one of the things that I truly do believe is that every state should require some sort of class, or at the least every person should go out, even if the state doesn't require it, and involve themselves in some sort of class to learn as much as they can about guns before they dive into the actual purchase.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chris, for your comments and sharing that with us and your question. And let me break with you, and let me pick up Gordon, KY6V. Gordon, welcome back aboard.
Hey, thanks, Susie. KY6V here, and good evening to you, Chris, way up there in Pennsylvania. Nice to have you aboard tonight. I want to hear more of Nancy. Eric, I am just enjoying listening to you and your wealth of knowledge, but I want to hear the prettier side of your pair up there. And I would like to hear from you, Nancy, whether you have any suggestions to get more women involved in pursuing, at least to the point where they have some ability and flexibility in defending themselves with the armament that we're talking about. And if you care to, Nancy, or you can pass this to Eric, I want to go back to the 9mm. I didn't realize that they had smaller size 9mm, Eric. The one that I had was a Colt. It was a beautiful gun, but it was just as heavy and maybe a little heavier than my .357 Magnum. So give me some manufacturers and I'll do some snooping. Susie, pass it over to Nancy. I want to hear her pretty voice. Over.
Well, very good. This is N1SUZ Suzanne, and this is the TNT Open Forum, and you are absolutely right, Gordon. Nancy has been way too quiet tonight, and I have not picked on her. And Eric has just been taken over here, but that's all right. Nancy's right here, and she is ready for her debut. Nancy, take it away.
Hello, Gordon. How are you?
He's my hair's butt.
And basically, to try and get more women involved in the sport, our
gun club, and hopefully other gun clubs around the United States are also offering classes for women to come and shoot at their clubs. They will teach them the handgun safety, basically a general version of the NRA course, and we'll go over the fundamentals, and we'll teach them how to handle and shoot the gun properly. Again, it's all a matter of preference. I've got several girlfriends who have attempted to try and shoot a gun, but couldn't get over the stigma that's associated with the guns, and were not confident in themselves or actually comfortable with handling it, which I think comes in time. Of course, when I first started, it wasn't an easy thing to do, but as time went on and I got more practice and I started actually hitting the target and seeing the bullets land in the correct spot, which didn't take too long, and my husband always yells at me for shooting better than him. shouldn't shoot his own gun better than him. but I think it's something that you can't really push on anyone, but you can try and introduce them slowly and gradually.
And I have to add, too, and I don't know if you felt this way, too, Nancy, but after I had that fear initially when I started shooting, but after I shot for a little bit and noticed that I wasn't hurt by the gun, that nothing happened, that I think that I just started to relax and actually have fun, you know, shooting the target and seeing how good I could get with it. And I imagine target shooting is probably something you enjoy a lot.
Target shooting is something I really enjoy, and actually I can tell you a story about when Eric and I went up to his uncle's house in upstate New York, and he thought it would be really cool, this little city girl coming up here into the country, to have her shoot this little .22 rifle that he had. So I was like, okay, let's try this out. So he lays out some little soda cans and a couple of little bigger targets, you know, the plastic bottle soda, 2-liter bottle soda. So he lays them out there, and I hit every single target, and he just could not believe it. He was floored. So something to go for
girl power
there.
All right. So I hope that answers your question, Gordon. And yes, Nancy's enjoying herself now talking. And we'll just hand it back to Eric for the follow-up question on 9mm.
All right, Gordon. Actually, the thing is that almost every major manufacturer is now making a small, compact 9mm. Sig Sauer, Kel-Tec is the one I mentioned there. They're actually out of Florida. Ruger is now making a really nice little compact 9mm, and I can't think of the model designation off the top of my head. Sorry about that, but if you look on their website, I'm sure it'll be right there. There's quite a few different companies out there now coming up with nice little small 9mm that are fairly easy to shoot and very easy to conceal. I do highly recommend the Ruger one. I have shot one, and it sure feels good. But to be honest with you, it's basically an exact copy of the Kel-Tec we just talked about, and the Kel-Tec is a little bit less expensive. You know, so if you're looking for a little bit of savings, it might be worth looking at the Kel-Tec instead of the Ruger, since they're basically the same gun.
Okay. I'll do that. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate that very, very much. One last question, Eric. Do you, for personal safety, prefer a belt holster, sling holster? What is your preference? Because everybody flips a little differently, over.
Everybody does. I prefer a belt holster. I'm not real comfortable with a shoulder holster. I'm assuming that was the second one that you mentioned, a shoulder style, which would be a strap would go over both shoulders and the gun would hang under one side, and if it was a semi-auto, you'd normally on the off side be able to hang a couple of magazines, extra magazines. I'm just not really comfortable with that. For me, it's just not a very comfortable way to carry. I do like a belt holster on my side. If I'm not wearing a belt holster on my side and I'm in a summertime when it's a lot warmer out and more difficult to conceal. There are vests out there that are designed with carry pockets in them. They actually have more material over where you would put the gun so that it stops the gun from imprinting or showing up on the outside of the material. And also the fanny pack that I mentioned, you know, you don't have to wear it around your waist. You can sling it over your shoulder as well, and it's pretty comfortable to carry around that way.
All right, looks like we're getting some key ups out of the Key West area here. All right, Eric, well, thank you very much. I happened to watch a video. In fact, it was within the last week, of a gal that had some kind of a holster that was under the T-shirt that she was wearing. It was very impressive. She could take one swoop with her hand under her T-shirt and grab that gun and start firing. Do you have any idea what she was wearing for a holster? Over.
Yeah, actually, funnily, I actually do. I got an email from the NRA today from their store, and they show that holster as one of the holsters they're selling. It actually attaches to the center of the bra, and it's a Kydex holster, which is a plastic-type holster, and when you pull down on it, the gun just snaps out of the holster. I'm pretty certain that's the one she was probably using. I don't know the manufacturer off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
But Eric's going to find out because Nancy and I were talking about it earlier.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate both of you being with us tonight. Susie, back to you, KY6V.
All right, this is N1SUZ, Suzanne, and let me open it back to the floor, and we're winding down tonight. Anybody have any final questions or comments for Eric or Nancy? Please come aboard now with your suffix only, please. Well, Net recognizes Jim, KJ4WKD. You were a little light on your audio, though, Jim, but come on aboard.
Thanks, Susie. KJ4WKD again. I have a paddle holster. I don't like it. Then again, I don't carry. But Eric might address his feelings about those. I have another question, and before we run out of time, I've just learned about the little small Detonics, I believe they're called, little small 45s that I find very interesting, and I'm wondering what Eric might think of that. It's a semi-automatic, of course, but it's almost a replica of a 1911, but it's really small. So. I'll send it back to you and get Eric's comments on that one. Thanks, Susie.
Yeah, there are a number of manufacturers making small 45s as well now. You mentioned the Detonics. Kimber, who makes excellent 1911 45s, and by 1911, that's kind of the style of 45. They're all based off of the original military 1911 A1, which the military used for 80 years until they moved to the Beretta 9mm. And they're great guns. I'll tell you that I'm a 45 fan. I'd say 95% of the time when I do carry a 45. Now, it may not be a small one, but that is generally what I do carry. Sends a big bullet out there, and if you need it to do what you need it to do, it's going to do the job. The only disadvantage in going smaller with a gun that's shooting a larger bullet is the recoil factor. So these are things you have to consider when you're deciding what you can carry, what you want to carry. We do have a couple of small 45s, but I have an older pair of Ordnance, which is a small short barrel 45. A lot of the companies are coming out with them now, Springfield Armory, Sig Sauer is even coming out with 45s now. Ruger is making a 1911 45. It's just such a classic in the industry that pretty much every manufacturer out there now is making some form of it in some way, shape, or form. And a lot of them are building smaller ones as well.
Okay, Jim, does that cover your question?
Yes, it does. The 45 is just an excellent for stopping power, and have it in a small frame is for carry is would be really nice. So yes, it does, and I'll let you get back to it. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thanks, Jim, for that question, and thanks for coming aboard tonight. Now, we've talked a lot about gun safety tonight, and mostly this would be precautions for adults to follow, whether or not there are any children in the home. But there are plenty of people out there who do have children who are listening tonight, and can you talk to any specific precautions that we should have in mind when there are children in the home?
Well, I'll throw a couple of things out there. Obviously, safe storage is number one. You know, somewhere that little hands can't get a hold of them. And again, we'll go right back to the safes. If I had children in the home, I would most definitely have a safe. Now, as I mentioned, we have a couple of safes anyway. But having children, I would absolutely have a safe to store it in. Secondly, and in my mind, probably just as important, is to get your children involved in the sport as soon as you feel they could handle it. And, you know, this can vary. We do a children's league over the summer, actually. And generally speaking, we allow 8 to 9-year-olds as the youngest and go up to 16. And they shoot once a week. Now, this is rifles, not handguns, but it's getting them involved in the sport. It's teaching them about the guns and how to handle them properly, and that's the number one thing. And also teaching them, you know, those basic rules, first the basic rules of gun safety, but also the basic rules, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, that they teach in that Eddie Eagle safety program, which is stop, don't touch, leave the area, and tell an adult. And, you know, those things are very important for the kids to learn, but it's also important for them to understand what really happens with a gun. What they see on TV is fake. They understand that. They know that, you know, they watch their cartoons, the cartoon gets up and walks away. You know, so they have to understand that it's real. This is what happens with it when something happens, when there's an accident or, you know, there's negligence with it. So it's very important to teach your children from as young an age as you feel is proper for your kids as they're growing up, to learn about the guns and learn how to handle them properly with an adult for starters until they're old enough to handle them by themselves.
Okay. So that about does it for that. All right, very good. All right, so we're at the end of our program, and I will call last call for everybody out there asking you questions, but is there anything that you guys want to mention that we haven't talked about tonight about gun safety or getting your permit or license or... You've got the floor.
Well, I don't think there's anything about those subjects I'd like to address. I think I'd like to just address the fact that, you know, if you ever even thought about it, go out there, get involved, have some fun. It's a great sport. It's not what the media cracks it up to be. It's not people going out there shooting other people. You know, you hear all the bad stories because that's what the media wants to tell you. You don't hear all the good stories where the gun was used in self-defense, whether it was actually the trigger was pulled or not. It may have been brought out and used in self-defense just with a, hey, here's my gun. If you go do anything, I'm going to shoot you, and now I'm calling 911, and the criminal is apprehended. You know, no bullets ever fired. So just those ones that are used to prevent crimes without even ever having to pull the trigger. That being said, get involved in the enjoyable side of it. Go to a gun club. Shoot a shotgun. Throw some clay pigeons. It's pretty cool when you can shoot a clay pigeon out of the sky with a shotgun. You know, that's just the greatest fun in the world. And, you know, get in there with a handgun and shoot some paper targets. Get somebody to show you how to do it and enjoy it. And I'll tell you, 90% of everybody you meet in this sport are great people. They really love to teach. They really love to impart their knowledge. Whether it's really good knowledge or not is sometimes suspect, but they love to get other people involved. You know, I've never met anybody out at a range, you know, even just strangers, never met anybody who didn't enjoy showing other people their stuff. And oh, you want to try it? You want to shoot this? Oh, come on over. You can shoot it. You know, and that's the best part of the sport is the commonality, the enjoyment, the getting together with other people with it and just having a grand old time. Yeah, that's the best part of shooting, really. You know, there's those other things which, unfortunately, the guns get used for. Defense, you know, hopefully that's good. There's the negative sides of them when they're used by criminals. But the good side of them, which is what people don't see and what people don't hear from the news, is actually going to the range and just having a good time with it.
And we always do. Anytime I've been to the range, it's been a lot of fun. So, Nancy, any final comments?
No.
All right.
I think he's covered them all.
There you go. There you go. Okay, let me break here for a minute, guys, and let me ask if anyone else out there has any final comments or questions for our special guests tonight, Eric and Nancy Shanahan. This is N1SUZ, and this is the TNT Open Forum. Please come aboard with your suffix only, please. Okay, so we're winding down tonight, and I want to thank Eric and Nancy for coming aboard TNT tonight and to talk to us about gun safety. I've only been bugging Eric for about a couple months now to do it. And it was really informative, and, you know, a lot of information. And if anybody had any questions out there, I'm sure they were answered tonight. And we all encourage you to get your licenses. At least go to an NRA safety course, even if you're not going to get your license.
Absolutely.
So anyway, thanks again. And we're going to let you go, and we're going to close up the net. But before I do that, I want to thank everybody for coming aboard, too. I am going to call on Gordon, KY6V, and see if he has some announcements for the rest of the week coming up. Gordon, KY6V, can you come aboard and tell us what's coming up this week on South Cars?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Susie. But I want to thank Nancy and Eric for being with us tonight. Just a great presentation. And Eric, I had to smile with some of your comments, sir. You have to realize that I spent 50 years in the television broadcasting business, retired from one of the major networks. Sensationalism is the word that you didn't use. That's what sells the news. And when you sell the news, you get everybody pumped up, your ratings go up. And that means that you can charge more for your commercials. And that's one reason. I've been retired for 11 years, Eric, and I don't turn my television on anymore. All right, let me take a break here. I'll give a couple of announcements, send it right back to you, Susie. Stand by, please. All right, guys and gals, we're looking for NCSs, administration people, and hospitality people. You know, we're getting very close to 12,000 members in our membership. That's both HF and our digital side combined. There's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes. We could use some help. If you think you're interested in learning a little bit more about this and maybe helping us out, we'd like to have you drop us an email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. We'll get into conversation and answer your questions, tell you what the situation's all about, see if we can get you interested, and I won't say put you to work, come and have fun with us. We'll put it that way. The other announcement is the next South Cars Outreach course that will be presented will be the International Morse Code course beginning on January the 29th this year, 2012. It'll be starting at 7 p.m. in the evening Eastern Daylight Time. That's 0000 Zulu. And all interested parties should contact us at the same email address for registration if you'd like. And that again is voip@voipnet.southcars.com. With that, back to you, Susie. Make sure that you give them some champagne on their way out tonight because it was a great show. KY6V, over.
Well, very good. Yeah, they can stay for anything. I even have Mrs. Fields cookies here. Nobody's eating them. Coffee, water. You know, we've got the whole thing going here. But
his idea with the champagne.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I think I might have champagne here. But Eric tells me he's got to work tomorrow. So do I. Anyway, Nancy. Anyway, thanks, Gordon. Thanks, everybody, for coming up tonight and partaking in our gun safety talk. And this has been South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. VOIP, net schedules, and general information may be found on the VOIP.SouthCars.com website. Your net control for this session has been me, Susie, N1SUZ, and I am saying 73s and closing this VOIP net session. Thank you for your participation. The net is officially closed. Good night, everyone.